Open. Good morning, fellow revenuers. We are going to look at some amendments to House Bill 2830. We are on a work session on House Bill 2830. And Paul, if you could give us the overview on what both of these do, I think as a bottom line, the one thing that is removed from this bill now is the repeal of what we call the grand bargain tax cut. That is no longer being repealed in this bill. And so they are identical with the exception of the dash fives exempts ag and forestry and fishing. So let me go through the details.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue. The difference, the dash four makes a number of changes. I'll go through those with you, but you're correct that the most significant one, certainly in terms of revenue, is it does not repeal the pass-through rate from 2013, and that has significant revenue implications. We'll look at that at first, and then go through the other changes. But the dash five has all of the changes from the dash four, but instead of having ag and natural resources at a 0.15 rate, they become excluded persons. In other words, they would be exempt and wouldn't be required to file or pay the minimum under the dash five. So we'll go through those. We have a summary. I'll pull up the summary document for the dash fours. This is the summary of revenue impact. These are the pieces that you're familiar with. As I said, this contains the 0.15 rate on natural resources. Still has the $3 million threshold. Has the 50% pass-through credit for 1 year and then for 25% starting in 2020. We also have the rate structure we had talked about, the 4.0, 6.7, 5.8, 8.9, and 9.9, so we created an additional bracket. We had in our simulations revenue impacts on the dash 3, we did have the ITC in at 10%. Now we have that language in the dash 4, so that's been added, and I'll show you that. And then we have the so-called corporate, or the bridge corporate tax rate increase for 2 years, and then the corporate income tax goes away in 19. The biggest impact, as I said, was there's no elimination of the pass-through rates, so your net revenue the revenue from the CAT itself minus the pass-through CAT credit, it goes to the education fund. We have a lot more language on that in the dash fours. I'll go through that with you. The tax on motor fuels will go to the highway fund, and then the general fund will receive that corporate rate increase for 2 years. So that's most of what goes into that, minus the income tax rate reduction. So you get 616 in the first biennium, 914 in 1921, and you can see it's growing as the CAT base grows, basically with the overall economy. We think the CAT rate will pretty much match the growth rate for personal income. So, and that, of course, is in contrast to our current corporate income tax, which is largely flat over time. So that's the dash four. And then the dash five, a summary, all the same, with the exception of ag and natural resources are exempt or in the language of your bill or excluded persons. So the revenue impact difference is not significant in the first year. It's 612 minus versus 616 for net revenue. And then in 21-23, you can see it's 895 versus 914. So the a difference there of about 19 million. That's the difference of going from the 0.15 rate down to, in effect, the zero rate is $19 million for the 1921 biennium. So when we look at the ag and natural resource sector, we look at it in terms of the overall economy, the gross domestic product for Oregon. It's about 1.9%. So that's what we think it is, about what it is in terms of the tax, the CAT base. So those are those two. We can look at our simulation. Well, maybe we should go through the amendment with you first, then we can look at the OTIM simulation, which is pretty similar to what you've seen. So they're the dash four. So they're all the dash four and five are about the same size because they have just about all of the same things in them. The first change is on page 4. There's a new section 1A, and that is the section that changes the earned income tax credit from 8% to 10%. Remember, one of the things you did last session was create a special EITC for those with dependent children, two or less, for at 11%. That would stay at 11%. So this just goes from 8 to 10 for the general EITC. The next change is around the provider tax. It's on page 7, lines 9 through 12. Basically, the key line there is line 11 through 12. It says any entity subject to assessment under section 3, 5, and 9, the chapter that's about to be prepared, is House Bill 2391, which passed the House floor last week. Mm-hmm. So anybody that's subject to the provider tax under that provision is not subject to the cap. So, or that would be future as well. The next thing I wanted to refer to was on page 13. Some of the gross receipts, the not gross receipts section, where remember we have a general definition of gross receipts, then we have a whole list of things that are not gross receipts in term for purposes of the CAT. The first one we changed was section Z, which starts on 13. This is the one that we've been trying to get at the wording for a wholesaler who purchases something from an in-state producer for the purpose of selling it out of the state. And so there was some intent language in the previous version. We changed that to the wholesaler will sell. So in other words, the wholesaler says, I will sell this out of the state. So the Department of Revenue can come back, did you do it or did you not? And if they didn't, then of course they're not eligible for that exemption. We also narrowed the AA, starting on line 16, which was the single unit machinery, high expensive machinery. This is really aimed at the tech sector, where you have a very expensive machinery that's purchased out of state. It comes in and is a key source of capital, physical capital in the production process. So we limit it to this. We're calling this the NAICS session because we're using NAICS code so many places. But this is the 334 NAICS, which is a really high-tech electronic semiconductor industry. So if you have buy a piece of equipment, for example, let's say $10 million, the CAT tax would only be calculated up to $5 million. So it would have a ceiling of $5 million. Anything above $5 million, it would still pay the CAT based on $5 million. At the bottom of the page, you have a fair number.
Representative Smith Warner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought that I heard you say just slightly different things right in a row there. Whether the $5 million is a ceiling, and so you pay up to that and then not over it, or
yes,
that is the point at which it starts at and you pay the CAT on whatever is over that.
Representative Smith Warner, it's the former. It would be, so if you bought, say there was a sale of machinery worth $15 million, mm-hmm, this would be manufacturing. So you would calculate the 0.48 rate on $5 million, not $15
million.
So the $5 million works similar to the SIP, the way it works with the property tax.
Representative Buehler, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So Paul, this exemption wouldn't hold for other machinery sold outside of the state that's not North American Industry Classification System Code 334?
Representative Buehler, this would be machinery that's sold into the state. So anything sold outside the state is not subject to the CAT. So this would be machinery sold into the state. So if you're you're a manufacturer in Oregon and you're buying expensive machinery from outside the state, normally that would be subject to the CAT because it's destination based. So you'd be selling it into Oregon. But what we're saying is that the manufacturer who is purchasing this machinery, they're not subject to the CAT, but the seller is. The seller into the state for this expensive equipment, that the amount of the tax would be capped at $5 million, so 0.48% of $5 million.
pull up then?
Yes, Representative Buell.
So why is the computer and electronic product manufacturing sector carved out when other segments of the manufacturing economy is not? What's the return here, let's say, opposed to Freightliner buying a piece of equipment or, you know, biotech industry buying a very expensive piece of equipment?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Buehler, that's certainly something you could look at as a policy decision. I think the rationale for you for putting it in initially is because the tech sector is so capital intensive that you get very very expensive machinery within it, and so the idea behind the cap would be to protect the competitiveness of the firms operating in Oregon who are eventually exporting their products. But you could certainly look at other sectors as well.
Thank you.
Okay, so down at the bottom of page 13, we got some new language primarily from the PUC on, you can see public utility and defining some of the various components of the low-income assistance program, monies collected from surcharges collected under ORS 757, monies passed through the utility, Bonneville Power Administration, all of that down to line 23. On page 14 with new language we got from the PUC, and it's really trying to design with that intergovernmental transfers or transfers among governmental programs so that those receipts are not subject to the CAT. So again, this is the not gross receipt subject. So the next thing I wanted to refer to was page 19. Line 15 there on page 19 about this is the nexus section where we talked about the bright line nexus, and there were some limits of 50,000 for property, 50,000 for payroll, and then we had 500,000 for gross receipts, which was really tied, I think, to the Ohio language where we started from, and I'm sure there was some reason in Ohio that they settled on that. But it wasn't consistent with your filing threshold, which is $150,000. So we modified that. Instead of a $500,000 gross receipts threshold, we made it $150,000, which seemed consistent with how our treatment of it for in-state sellers. So that's $150,000. You can see that on line 16 there, page 19. The next page, on page 20, again, we have the ag, forestry, and fishing sector at 0.15. So that's spelled out in this, and that's, of course, where we see the change in the dash fives. Page 25.
Taylor.
Mr. Chair.
Taylor.
Senator Taylor.
Okay, thank you, Chair Hess. Can you just go over, I'm sorry, explain a little bit more about the 0.15 versus, it seems to be, I'm looking, trying to see the significant differences between the dash 4 and the dash 5, and having the natural resources exempt in one and then having the 0.15 in the other, between the 4 and the 5. I just was wondering if someone could kind of walk me through what the implications are throughout the whole proposal, how much of a difference that's making.
The difference in terms of the two amendments are that sub D there is gone in the dash fives, and the ag and natural resources shows up under the excluded persons category, which would be where we have nonprofits, for example. So they would not be subject to the CAT. They would not have to file. They would not pay the minimum. So they would simply be exempt. And if you saw the revenue numbers, we showed you that the revenue impact of that change between the two amendments for a full biennium, 1921, is about $19
million. Okay,
$19 million. Now, the ag sector, you have a lot of players, and, you know, we would expect to see, if they were to file under the $3 million, or especially under a $1 million threshold, there's a lot of filers, but they tend to be relatively small. So a lot of them, the vast majority of them would pay the minimum. Mm-hmm. Although you have some, you know, some larger producers that would be over the threshold, and that's who we're picking up in that $19
million. Okay.
So the next section I wanted to mention was on page 25. And Chris did quite a bit of work in consultation with Department of Revenue, kind of about this financial institutions, or what we call the FIT. In Ohio, they have a separate tax, but we've included financial institutions under the CAT. But we have to do a fair amount of special language in terms of what constitutes a gross receipts for financial institutions, much as we do for the corporate income tax. So we added a few things in there. For example, one of the things that was added is section or lines 25 through 30 there at the bottom of page 25, which adds in fees for automatic teller machines. And then back on the page top of 26, we added in receipts from security holdings. So you get kind of an area of distinction between income and receipts. But that's consistent with the language we use for the corporate income tax under the financial institutions, which has a separate chapter under the corporate. It actually is the corporate income tax instead of the excise tax. Page 33, the next. There's quite a bit. There's some adjustments around the Education Strategic Investment Fund. And the percentages have changed a bit. The 70%, if you look on page 33, starting on line 5, 70% of the CAT money, remember this is CAT money minus the pass-through CAT credit, goes to the fund. 70% of it goes to K-12. And the new language that we added in here was starting on line 6 and line 7, supporting the state school fund. So that was, and making strategic investments in these other areas. The reason for that is if you look at the general fund from our impact sheets, general fund goes down by over $1 billion because the corporate income tax goes away and all of the CAT money goes into this fund. So some of the fund will be used in terms of supporting the state school fund. Then 20% of the monies are going to public university fund, and with 2/3 going to the public university fund and 1/3 of the 20% going to the community college support fund. The community college support fund was created the same time the school distribution formula was, when Measure 5 passed. So it's really, its origin was to backfill property tax revenue lost from Measure 5. So it had that same function. The C on 19 is 10% of the monies in the strategic investment funds go for purposes of providing early intervention services, special education programs, and other early learning programs. So it's kind of a general direction to early learning programs. So, the next section I wanted to refer to is way back in the back, 123. We added some language, and on page 123, starting in section 99A, this is language referring to the qualified investment contracts. So,
back to order. Rep. Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairs and Paul, has there been any conversation on how to make it just a little bit more challenging to modify those Section 28 to make it just a little bit more difficult for the legislature to change its mind? Section 28, to referring to the Education Strategic Investment Fund.
Representative Smith and Mr. Co-Chairs, yeah, this is kind of the language that we've gotten from leadership in terms of what they had discussed. This is obviously, we're getting into the realm of the ways and means and how that budget process works ultimately. So it's kind of what the trade-off is between trying to make it very specific that it's used for something versus flexibility in the future as to what might come up and how it might be used best. So those kinds of trade-offs go into that decision.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so back to 123, page 123 in section 99A. The qualifying investment contracts, you recall from special session in 2012, not 2013, but 2012. What this does is provide some language for modifying these qualified investment contracts, which the legislature gave the governor the authority to enter into these contracts for up to 30 years. And so we have two major ones that were agreed to with the Nike and with Intel. And so what this does is if it provides some language around the CAT, as we talked about at our last meeting, the CAT conceptually really does focus on the same base as we do under our single sales factor, which was really the basis for those agreements. However, there is a significant difference between using gross receipts or as the base itself versus apportioning it. And that's, of course, the structural change you get here from going from a net income tax to a gross receipts-based tax. So what this language says is if there's changes in the future that affect the rates of firms that are in this qualifying agreement by more than 10%, then there can be the governor can reopen that negotiation at the request of the participant in the agreement. So it's a trigger if there's more than a 10% increase in taxes caused by a rate change, not by growth of the base, but by a rate change, then the recipient of the other side of the agreement, the firm, can request a renegotiation or a reopening of the discussion with the governor. So it gives the governor the authority to do that in that case. So that's what the language is all about down through the bottom of page 125. So the final piece that is kind of hard to find, which is why I mentioned it's a significant difference between this and the dash 3, but also hard to find, is the pass-through special rate, which if you look on section 100 on page 127, it gives a whole list of things that are repealed. Well, if you really look closely, there are two things that are in dash 3 that are not in dash 4. 316.043 and 316.044 are no longer repealed by this measure, by this amendment. So that's a huge difference between the two. And that's about, that's the summary. And I'll go to the dash 5. We may have to go to the emergency board, Mr. Chair, for our copying budget after these sized amendments.
Yeah, I might already be there.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I've decided not to print this one out because for exactly the same reason.
So with all these pages, they are identical with the exception of page 7 for the dash. I'm on the dash 5s. If you look, there's under M in section 4, lines 14 through 16, this is where I was referring to earlier about the Ag and Natural Resources. Hunting is actually part of that NAICS classification, so Kate put in the full title of that section, which is NAICS Code 11. So that gives us a clear definition in terms of to refer to. But it's an excluded person is someone, again, who doesn't have to file, who's not subject to the minimum. And then you see the other corresponding change that Senator Taylor referred to on page 20. You'll notice that the 0.15 bracket is gone. So that's the only change in the dash 4 and the dash 5.
Representative Marsh, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Chair Haas. Do we have any, going back to that sector, the agriculture forestry sector, do we have any idea what percentage of those entities are C-Corps?
We know how many C-Corps are in that sector. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, we've been going kind of back and forth on this entity level issue, It's we know how many C-Corps are in that section because we have tax returns in Oregon today. We know how many we have an estimate of how many would file under the CAT total, all entities, based on our Ohio estimates that we've modified for Oregon's larger ag sector. But we don't have any hard data on what those, how many non C Corp entities are filing now. We know farm proprietors, for example. So is that accurate? So that's the problem we've had. We don't have a database that has all these different filers. All we have are C Corps that we've got by industry, by sales, where we have the detailed data. And we've been making estimates for the overall CAT from these inferences from both Washington and Ohio data.
Follow up?
It does seem like there could be an equity issue there, because the C Corps within that sector would wind up paying no taxes at all. Whereas the other organizations would still be paying through the individual income tax by eliminating the CAT obligation fully.
Representative Marsh, we've talked about this, that would be a possibility, and for those that are in that sector. I guess the only thing about, and I think Co-Chair Barnhart raised this the other day, is that for corporations, individuals that are stockholders in that, when they receive dividends from that entity, that is subject to the personal income tax. So the corporation does certainly have more flexibility in terms of retained earnings, and those would not be subject to a corporate income tax if that goes away and the entire sector is exempt. That's correct.
Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. Paul, you want to pull up my wonder chart there? One of the disturbing things I've had on this bill is that so many changes can be made in this bill with just a simple majority vote. So, Dr. Warner, if you could explain that chart, I'd appreciate it.
Members of the committee, Senator Bertschinger asked us to look at the revenue impact of different threshold levels, and of course we've been looking at this since going back to the discussions of the revenue work group months ago, and you have different examples from the states we've looked at. We've used the $3 billion threshold, and of course the advantage there is you have a large number of firms, a very large number of firms actually, that are just paying the minimum, so they're not subject to the CAT, so you're narrowing who's affected. But as you move up that scale, we have the orange line there is a $2 million threshold, and then we have the Ohio model, which is the kind of gray line there, is a $1 million threshold, and you can see the revenue differential. And then if you go all the way to the Washington system, which doesn't have a threshold, everybody who's subject to has receipts is subject to that. Now you still have exemptions and deductions that can affect it, but basically you have to file if you have receipts in Washington, and that's the yellow line. So you're bringing in a lot more taxpayers. You're bringing in more revenue and more taxpayers as you lower that threshold, and that's what Senator Bertschinger asked us to look at for exactly what that would do.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So over the last few weeks, I've looked into the Ohio model, the Nevada model, and the Washington state model. Nevada, I don't think, is a fair comparison because, one, it's fairly new, so we don't know if it's working. The other thing is so much revenue comes into Nevada from the gaming, which is primarily tourism, is flipping the bill. So I looked at Washington, and our model looks more like Washington, and as the amendments are coming forth, it's even looking more like Washington with the carve-outs. Because if you look at Washington's model, which has been going on since the 30s, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of carve-outs and tax credits and exemptions. And as our amendments come forward, we're already seeing those carve-outs. So, Mr. Chair, I think we should change the nickname of this bill from the Son of 97 to the Oregon Lobbyist Dream.
Other comments? Okay, Paul.
So that takes us through the amendments, and then the last thing we had to show you was the simulations. So we got some simulations run for these over the weekend. No surprises here, really, and as I say, it's always somewhat reassuring when you make small changes and it doesn't lead to big changes in the model. The dash 4 simulation, which we went through with you, compared to the dash 3, really the only significant change in terms of OTEM is the elimination of the taking out the repeal of the pass through. And basically what that does is if you look at the compared to the dash 3 simulation, on the employment side you see a slightly smaller employment impact. The dash 3 had a +3,000 and the dash 4 has a +2,300. So not a significant employment impact from removing that pass-through rate. You do see a little bit less on the investment side, $39 million, and you see $34 million instead of $39 million compared to two sims. Price effects are the same. The biggest impact between the 3 and the 4 is under the distribution of the tax impact, and that is there's a much smaller impact on the above 205,000 group, roughly 0.3%, versus 0.5% if you repeal the pass-through in that same bill. And that, of course, as Chris has showed you with the tax data, that largely goes to a high-income group that are receiving that income. So that's the difference. The economic simulation, I would say, is very similar. You get you're raising revenue, you still get some small positive employment investment impacts, and you get a distribution that's more proportional under the dash 4 than you do under the dash 3, but you still get a slight progressive impact as it moves up in those higher groups with a little bit bigger impact on the higher income group percentage wise. So then the dash 5s is also very similar. Lowering that ag rate is not a sector where we see a lot of employment directly, so the net effect is a very small change in investment, very small change in the feedback, and largely a very similar to the dash 4 simulation. So again, small positive employment and investment impacts through the combination package that you have. So, throw the floor open to you for questions.
Questions on the sims, the 4s and 5s. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Birchinger talked about the ability to modify the floor with a majority vote. What about the amount and the recipients of the pass-through credit? Would that be modified via simply a majority vote, or is that a 3/5 requirement?
Representative Johnson, I'll give you my understanding. What we worked on, and Kate can clarify as well. We have been working on a bill that does modify the pass-through eligibility in the Senate, Senate Bill 164. As I say, I think this is the session for the NAICS, but to limit it to certain NAICS categories, their traded sector. Increase employment requirements. So we've been working with that, and the opinion we've had so far from LC is that it is a majority vote.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I guess I know what you're referring to there is the 2013 bill, but in terms of the, let's just say, the 0.25 credit that's applied here in the mm-hmm. CAT, that also then would be modified, could be modified with a majority vote as well, correct? Because it starts out as a 0.50, goes down to 0.25, but that might be changed as well.
Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Kay Toswell from Legislative Council, Special Counsel and Chief Editor. Our understanding is with any of these provisions that are going to make changes to an existing tax that are not specifically changes to a rate, an increase in a rate, the likelihood under the recent City of Seattle decision and the other case that we rely on, which is Boba versus Kulongoski, is that these changes are changes to the base, and not, they don't have the features of a bill levying a tax, which is the language that we see in Bobo and also in City of Seattle. And so without further additional guidance from the courts, it's our understanding that when what we're doing is adjusting the base and not actually imposing a new tax or imposing an increased rate, that those are not for origination purposes or for supermajority purposes. They're not considered bills for raising revenue. Again, with the understanding, with the case law we have to this point.
Kate, if we didn't pass this tax, that all still applies to the corporate income mm-hmm. tax, right? Or any other tax we have, if we want to change the structure of the base, that's what you just said still applies.
At your house, yes, that is correct. We would be looking at the current corporate excise tax, the tax under Chapter 317, and again, making those changes to the base would, in our understanding, require only a simple majority and not a three-fifths.
So while I appreciate the concern of Representative Johnson and Senator Bertschinger, whether we pass a new tax or that doesn't change anything, it's just something that happened. It's a court decision. That still applies to everything else, whether we pass this or whether we pass a tax on guitar players.
Chair House, that is accurate. And again, the guidance we have to this point is City of Seattle. There are points in that opinion that, if they're further explored, may not be the last word from the Oregon courts. But that's the word that we have to rely on at this point. And I think it's also important to remember. Not every bill that brings money in and has a positive revenue impact is going to be a bill for raising revenue. And that is something I think we're clear on, and that will probably continue to be the case even with further judicial guidance.
Rep. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By the way, this is good stuff.
I play guitar and so yeah. that stuff. All right.
Yeah, this is good stuff. I remember a few years back when we were doing the business energy tax credit, no one foresaw that large energy producers would take their company and break them up into small little companies in order to qualify for maximum BETC credit. Have we thought through the likelihood of companies switching their legal form of business to take advantage of this opportunity? And again, I don't know what I don't know on this, but has there been any type of thought or an analysis of folks who would switch their legal form?
Mr. Co-Chair, as Representative Smith, yeah, it clearly is a risk. I know Senator Bertschinger has referred a number of times, you're going to get a response in the business sector when you change the structure. A couple of things, though. We do think that really the driving force behind the structure that businesses use is still the federal system. So the taxes are higher and the costs and benefits are higher. We may see some switches in the margin, but you know, under this type of tax, you would have, under the way the CAT is constructed now, once you get over a certain threshold, you're going to have similar tax burdens under the CAT. So, and one of the ideas of the CAT is that it's entity-based, so the entity will matter less. Now, where we think it will matter, as Senator DeBoer has pointed out, that really you get, particularly around the margin of that threshold, you are going to see some changes in the tax liability for C-Corps versus pass-throughs in that category. So I think you may see some slowdown or at least or maybe some shift back towards C-Corps in some of that area of the scale, because we've had a long-term process of moving away from the C-Corp structure. Now, there's a lot of costs of doing that, and that's slowed that, but it's been a clear long-term evolution. So we may see some slowing down in that change as a result of this, particularly in those areas around the threshold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Paul, and everyone for this as usual. I am not, I think this is more of a comment than a question, but I just wanted to say a couple things just to talk through as we have worked through this process this year and in general. We talk a lot about the importance of having a stable system. We talk a lot about the importance of progressivity of our tax structure. basic fairness. Some of the things that I know we talk about trying to make up for are the fact that indeed business taxes or corporate taxes have been a declining share of our revenue, and we have a very unstable tax base. So I just want to comment on a couple things. I'm extremely troubled by taking out the pass-through credit because of indeed specifically how it shows up in the SIM about it mostly impacts the highest income areas, and that I do not believe that was the intention of it when it was passed. I was not here. And at the same time, in the models, that is where it is showing up. That's the significant difference, and I am struck by I'm struck by the that goes against what we are trying to do in being progressive and fair, I would argue. And number two, I just wanted to speak to the natural to the idea of exempting natural resources broadly, which I am opposed to because I believe that we are all partners in making this state a better place. We all need to contribute the things that we all share. We want to dealing with poverty, helping with job creation, all the things that we want as a state. The idea that we can or should exempt one sector because they don't have any need to invest in our shared goals of education and healthcare and public safety, I think that's a terrible precedent to set. I don't see any reason for us to go in that direction when what we continue to talk about is all of us wanting to contribute to a more balanced, fair, progressive, and stable system. And I think the idea of cutting out one whole chunk is just wrong.
Okay. I think we will take a pause for everyone to digest everything. I very much want to thank Kate Toswell. We spent Father's Day weekend barbecuing and stuff, and she spent her weekend in here writing up Section 4 definitions. And thank you very much for you and your team. I would remind everybody that the cost containment measures are still being worked on. They're downstairs in a Bill 1067 and 1068, which is part of whatever package we put together. And so I'd ask everyone to digest this. Thank you for your very productive and thoughtful discussion and questions today and all along, really. And why don't we reconvene this committee at 1:30 today? With that, we will adjourn. Reform is reconvening. Good afternoon. I'm going to go into a work session on House Bill 3469 simply for purposes of moving that bill to the House Committee on Revenue. And so,
Mr. Chair,
without recommendation, yes, Rep. Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3469 without recommendation as to passage and that a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue be added.
Rep. Barnhart moves House Bill 3469 without recommendation as a passage and then a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue be added. Did you want to speak to your motions?
Well, sir? Simply to say we've determined a different use for it than we had originally planned, and it needs to be in the House Committee instead of here.
Okay. Is there any discussion on this? Rep. Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And what's the purpose of the bill?
We're still working on that.
Further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Berger? No, probably. Beth Mueller?
No, for sure.
Madam Chair? We're just sending it to the committee.
Just sending it to the House Revenue.
Beth Marsh?
Yes.
Rep. Nose?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Rep. Smith?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Co Vice Chair Boquist? Co Vice Chair Schiffler?
Aye.
Co Chair Barnhart?
Aye.
Pass with aye. The measure goes to that committee. I will open up a work session on House Bill 2830. Committee members, this is yet another amendment on the bill we've been working on. However, this one does not involve the commercial activity tax. It's more along the terms that the parts of the Business Coalition offered up during the year, which is just some increases in the corporate tax rate, corporate minimums, and a limit to the pass-through special rate of the grand bargain deal. And Dr. Warner has some worksheets on it. The dash eights are being done. They're not up yet. They should be on OLIS momentarily, but in the meantime, Paul can walk us through his worksheet.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You can see up on the OLIS there, House Bill 2830-8, and that is in progress and should be done shortly. Couple of pieces in it. The first piece is the increase in the corporate tax rates. These are the same rates that you have in the dash 4 and 5 version of House Bill 2830. The only difference is that these are permanent changes. They're not a two-year change. So they would go to 8 and 9%. One of the things that as you make that change over time, there's a specific allocation for the a reserve fund, the rainy day fund that's made. And then, as you recall, that was adjusted when these rates were increased in the special session for the grand bargain. So we also will adjust those rates again up so that the threshold in which the money flows into reserve fund will be set so the reserve fund is held harmless, so that the dollars will flow into the general fund and the reserve fund will get what it's expected to get under current law. So that's what I mean by the hold RDF allocation harmless there. The second element is to limit the pass-through rate by industry and employment. And this is something that the Senate has put a good deal of time on, Senate Bill 162, which they've developed amendments for. And basically what it does is it increases the employment criteria from one person who is not an owner, member, or limited partner to 10 persons during each pay period who are not owners, members, or limited partners. So it increases employment from eligibility requirement from 1 to 10, and then it also limits the industries in which the special pass-through rate applies. Basically, it's designed to be aimed at traded sector industries, and the NAICS codes that you were looking at throughout your discussions around the CAT and the CAT rates also come into play here. The industries would be agriculture, forestry, fishing, mining, manufacturing of all forms, wholesale trade, transportation, warehousing, information, and accommodation and food services. So those sectors would all be eligible for the special pass-through rate. About the percentage of the current usage of the rate, we estimate to be about 26%. So in other words, the use of the impact would drop by 3/4 in terms of its current law impact on revenue. So those are the numbers you can see there. Limit the pass-through special rate would generate about $196 million in 2017-19, and then $227 and $244. So those numbers, again, are about 75% of the numbers that you saw in the last version, in which it was included in House Bill 2830. The final piece here, corporate minimum tax that was established under Measure 67. As you recall, it has a $150 minimum for S corps, partnerships, and small C corps. That would be doubled to $300, and each of the corporate minimum categories based on Oregon sales would be doubled. And so, when you get to the cap of sales over $100 million, it would go to Austin, just let me know the dash 8 is on OLIS, so you need to refresh. So we do have the dash. We actually have the official dash 8. So
you need to refresh.
Need to refresh. Always a good idea, Mr. Go-Chair.
Good
So good. So we got the actual language, and so the minimum for the cap, if you have over 100 million sales, would go from 100,000 to 200,000. And you can see we estimate that would generate about $130 million. Both the C Corp and all three of these would be applied to the 2017 tax year. And so we have language in the measure, in the amendment, that would direct the Department of Revenue to not impose penalties that are based on the change in law during the transition year of 2017. In other words, if you're under withheld or under paid on your estimates, you're not subject to penalty if it's the result of this law change. And this is something you typically do when you change rates during the middle of the year. So the totals you can see there, about $530 million for 17-19, and it gradually goes up to about $545 million in 21-23.
All right, thank you. Limiting of the pass-through special rate we did work on in the Senate committee, and I think if some of you recall, when Pat Kreitzer from the Business Coalition was here, he recommended we get rid of the suits and scrubs, which is to say the cardiologists who were utilizing this and the law firms which reorganized to take advantage of that. So I think that's what this tries to do. No offense, Dr. Buehler.
None taken.
He's an orthopedist, okay. So.
So that's what that change represents. It's the amendment that Senator Boquist helped work on, and the others are pretty well known standard fare to Revenue Committee members. Questions of Dr. Warner about this amendment, this worksheet.
One question,
Rep. Johnson.
Thanks. Paul, what was the criteria behind the numbers of personnel benefiting from the pass-through? I think you mentioned 10 or greater employees, is that right?
Representative Johnson, yes, that's correct. The employment level would be 10. And I'll ask Chris if he's got the number of filers. If you
Chris, come in.
Chris, on the estimates around the number of filers that are affected by the tier, that going to that tier two or the traded sector, do you recall how many filers would be affected by that? We know the revenue amounts, but not the filers.
Chair Haas, Prasalanak, Legislative Revenue Office. I can pull that up. There were about 13,000 filers in total in 2015 that claimed it, and I hesitate to go into any more detail than that. The information is in OLIS, and I can get it to the committee in terms of the number of filers. I just can't recall offhand.
Not in the meeting materials, though. It's elsewhere.
Elsewhere in OLIS. Yeah,
it is in there.
Any comments or questions on this amendment? Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You know, when we did the grand bargain, the whole intent was to help small business, entrepreneurs, people that are just starting out. And this wipes them out. It doesn't help them start out, it wipes them out. So we're after the little guy again.
Well, the testimony that we had was, that there were people who were out-of-state investors, there were wealthy doctors, and there were law firms literally restructuring to take advantage of this. That is not who I thought I was voting to help in that grand bargain vote. And maybe we should have put these limits on at the time, but we didn't, and that was a mistake.
Well, maybe we ought to articulate something to that, because, you know, this just discourages entrepreneurship, and that's a driving force, especially with young people and people that don't have the means and people just starting out. This wipes them out. It's incredible.
Further discussion. Okay, well, thank you all. We're going to remain in pause mode for a while. And I would encourage you, Senator Burchard, to offer up your own amendment or something that you might have. In the meantime, stay tuned.
So are you in recess still for the telecom chair?
We're going to recess for the day.
Okay.
That's adjourned, I think, is what that's called.
We'll adjourn. I was going to adjourn for the day, unless somebody else has an idea that says we should come back later tonight. No? Senator DeBoer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is this in lieu of, or putting the other on a pause, the gross receipts?
Yeah, this would not include the CAT tax.
And I think that gives us some time. So I think we're certainly on the right track, and it's interim,
this.
Would there be a sunset on this, you think?
There isn't one on there.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we will adjourn. Thank you. With that, we will adjourn.